Go ahead and open your Bibles to Revelation 21 and find your way to verse 9 as we continue our study in this great, great book. We're nearing the end of our journey, and it gets more and more exciting as we move forward through these last couple of chapters. Back in the earlier days of our country, as westward expansion was going on, in the year 1842, you had the first sizable group of people, pioneers, emigrate to what was known then as the Oregon Territory. And this group of people paved the way for mass migration from the middle of the country to the west coast of the country in 1843, the very next year. They departed from Independence, Missouri, and they traveled about 40 miles or 2 days' journey west, and the trail was identical to the Santa Fe Trail, and there was a signpost in the middle of nowhere, literally along this trail, that pointed in a direction and said, "This way is the road to Oregon." And they began the arduous task of riding and walking over 2,000 miles to get from their beginning point to their destination. They passed through places like Fort Laramie. They perhaps stopped at Independence Rock to register their names. They came to a place called Fort Boise, which was a Hudson Bay post on the Snake River, finally arriving at their new home. The trip definitely took its toll. It was too difficult for wagons to cross over. You had to walk or ride most of the way. Many had mocked them as they began their journey, but as people began to receive reports of what the country was like and how they were living, it began to build excitement in those who wanted to go to a new place. Again, these letters that the pioneers sent back were an encouragement. And we have the record of one particular letter that a man wrote back to his family, and it says this: "About 3 weeks ago, I took a horse and traveled about 50 miles. The weather was fine, and this country is seen to its greatest advantage. I do not believe there is a handsomer river in the far west or a better country. We celebrated the 4th of July in very good style for a new and wild country. About 500 persons came, and we all sat down to a dinner in the open air." As I go to this next part, put yourself in his shoes as he's writing to his family, in particular a brother, and think about what would really be appealing to you as a person in 1842 living in this place. He says, "I can buy a saddle of venison weighing 40 pounds or upwards for $1. Prairie chickens can be had in great abundance for the shooting. As you are something of a fisherman, I shall have to tell you what was did in 2 days a couple of weeks ago. There was at least 200 men and boys, all getting as many as they could drag, and some a wagon load. It went beyond anything I ever saw. The fish weighed from 5 to 30 pounds each. Deer are plenty within half a mile of the cabin, and very frequently not more than 20 rods distant. 10 have found their final resting place on the cabin roof," meaning his hunting had been successful. "I can kill one or two almost every time I go out." If you think about the mindset of a pioneer, this sounded like heaven on earth. The abundant supply, the natural resources, how they were being blessed, and what had been provided them. You know, the Apostle John has served as a pioneer in the vast frontier of heaven, writing back to us on orders from God himself to describe the wonders of what awaits all followers of Jesus Christ. After the description of many, many dark days of tribulation in the middle part of the book of Revelation because of mankind's rejection of God, these last two chapters here, they point us to the place where God's people will spend eternity, what we call in our vernacular heaven. Last week we looked at a new universe, a new city, a new nearness of God, and a new separation from what is worldly. John's now going to examine the New Jerusalem more closely and describe our future home. So with that in mind, let's look at verse 9, chapter 21. Our goal is to go all the way through verse 21 in this great, great chapter. "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasmine. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, and 3 gates on the north, and 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall. The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as its width. And he measured the city with the rod 1,500 miles, its length and width and height are equal. And he measured its wall 72 yards according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass. The foundation stones of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each one of the gates was a single pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. As we move through this passage, so much just fills our mind and amazes us thinking about what's being described here. But why is this important? Why is this important for us to understand this morning? Did you know that the word heaven and its related forms appear 275 times in the New Testament alone? Jesus says in the initial portions of his message to the crowds, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." There's something he's communicating to the people, that heaven is nearby now. They need to pay attention and turn from their old life and live for God. There are warnings to those who reject the gospel. And those warnings from Jesus say, you will not enter the kingdom of God unless you follow what he says. There are promises to those who are followers of Jesus, who are having faith in him and who are obedient to him. And those can be summarized in Jesus' words again, your reward in heaven is great. We're told in the New Testament that as Christians, our citizenship is in heaven. And so as you think about our lives now, we see that the place where we live on earth today, no matter where it is, it's just temporary. It's just a place that we're passing through. It's not our true home. It's not our true identity. The Bible calls us strangers and aliens. We're like ambassadors. We're like diplomats from another nation, another realm. You think of the entirety of the New Testament, and it strains toward eternity. And through it, the words of the New Testament, God calls us to incline our thinking heavenward. You can't lean towards something that you don't know anything about. If you try, ignorance might lead you to lean in the wrong direction. You might be thinking, I'm leaning in the right direction, but because you don't know about the details of where you're supposed to lean, you're going in the wrong way. Or you might lean in the right direction, but weakness of mind can cause you to lean sporadically, just when it's comfortable or just when you're aware of it. So the more solid you are in the knowledge of what God describes as heaven, the place that he has prepared for you, the more inclined you will be to live for him and in light of this place. So here we have our future home described. And in these verses, you'll see first our city's glorious appearance, then you'll see its staggering dimensions, and finally its magnificent composition. Look first at the city's glorious appearance, and John first talks about the city's radiance in verses 9 through 11. Now, what has to happen here is John has to get in the right spot. He's going to describe this place, so he has to position himself to see it accurately. He's going to take us on a guided tour through the city. And so the angel helps him out. Look at verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me. So remember that in the seven last plagues that were poured out upon the earth, there was a different angel who had each of the seven bowls of wrath that were being poured out. So one of those comes and speaks to John and says this, "Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." Now, the city itself, the New Jerusalem, is described as the bride back in verse 2. Look what it says there. John says, "I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband." And the location where we will live is now equated with ourselves being the inhabitants of that city. There's a merging of metaphors here. The city as a bride and the bride of Christ come together. And it's not uncommon for us to speak in the same way. You might hear in a news report, for example, England says, or Tokyo believes, as they describe the thinking of a particular nation or the leaders of a particular nation, and they identify a geographical location with individuals in that geographical location and what they think or believe or say. And so the same thing is happening here. Christ has fulfilled his promise in bringing this New Jerusalem down, and we will live there. And so there's an identification here of the bride of Christ with this bride coming out of heaven, the bride of the Lamb. Look at verse 10. "And he," this is the angel, "carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain." John's vantage point is going to be high up because he needs to be near heaven to see this thing descend upon the earth. And then it says in the middle of verse 10, "and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." Now again, back in verse 2 of this same chapter, John says that he sees the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. And what you have here is a recapitulation of what he's already seen. He says it's coming down out of heaven. He gets a new vantage point, then he sees it again coming down out of heaven. It's not happening twice. He's describing the same event. It's similar to Genesis 1 and 2, where we get two different perspectives of creation. You get the overall picture in Genesis 1, and then God goes back through it and describes more clearly, more detailed, the creation of man, Adam and Eve in particular, right? So here the same thing is happening, and John sees it coming down out of heaven. It is described as holy, meaning it's set apart. It is distinct. It is sanctified. It is pure. We, as followers of God, are called holy ones through the New Testament. And heaven is its source. Heaven is the place where it is constructed. Look at verse 11 now. John says that the city has the glory of God. The city comes down having the glory of God. Notice that it doesn't say it has the glory from God. It says it has the glory of God. This is not something that God has created and put it apart from himself and have it move through its purposes. It has the glory of God within and among and all around it. And it's caused by God himself. And as you think about what the essence of God's glory is, and John just says, "This city has the glory of God." This would be the most awe-inspiring aspect of all the details we see here in the description John gives of the New Jerusalem. It has the glory of God, and it's there. And this is where we're going to live. He goes on, though, and gives more detail, and we're thankful for the detail. He says, the middle of verse 11, "Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper." Its brilliance, literally, its luminary or its light. He's looking at this place, and John is using metaphors now to describe not God or not Christ or not spiritual warfare like he's done throughout the entire book, but he's describing the New Jerusalem, and it's so amazing that he can't just describe it. He has to use metaphors to bring it into our understanding that we might relate to what he's seeing as best as possible. And so he says, it has brilliance. In detail, he says, it is as a stone of crystal clear jasper. Now, jasper is not a word we use too often today to describe a stone. We would use more likely the word diamond-like, or similar to a diamond. Diamonds were not known at that time, and again, John's trying to describe the scene with words familiar to his original readers. So the city itself is transparent, it is gleaming, it's clear, with God's glory radiating in and through it. There's a dazzling splendor to the city as it descends from heaven, lighting up the entire earth and the entire sky. I don't know about you, but my own involvement with jewelry took place in the span of a few months, a little over 25 years ago, when I realized if I want to get married, I have to get a ring. I learned all I have ever known about jewelry, all I have ever needed to know about gems from the jewelry district in downtown LA. I learned the four C's, the carat, the color, the quality, or the clarity, and the cut. And in my particular situation, I needed a fifth C, and that was cost, because of budget. God blessed that whole process. But here, you don't have a small gem. You have a gem that is just monumental in size, and it's descending from heaven onto the earth. And the best way John can describe it is like it's a giant diamond coming down from heaven, resting upon the earth. So this New Jerusalem is perfect in every way, formed by God himself. And the impression that John has of the city is just off the charts. So that's the radiance. Look now at the wall of the city, just at the beginning of verse 12. John says, it had a great and high wall. Stop there. Now, this wall, as you think about ancient cities, there's a distinction. This wall is not for defense. And the reason we know that is because if you move down to verse 25, it says this. In the daytime, for there will be no night there, its gates will never be closed. So the gates are always wide open. The wall is not to defend enemies from getting in. It's just there for God's purposes. John is struck as he looks at this city and decides to describe it in detail. He's struck by the wall first, a single wall surrounding the city, and he looks at its size, its height, its width, etc., and he'll move through those details as we move through the rest of this passage. Look now at the gates, middle of verse 12. He says, the wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels. And names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. You see the word 12 there mentioned more than once, a significant number in this city, the New Jerusalem. There are 12 gates, there are 12 angels, there are 12 tribes' names, there will be 12 foundation stones, there are 12 apostles' names, there will be 12 pearls, doors to each of the gates. There are 12 fruit described in the next chapter. The wall is 144 cubits wide, 12 times 12. The city itself is 12,000 stadia as far as size go. And so we see God using this number over and over again in the construction of the city that John's now describing to us. The angels are stationed at each gate, and these are God's holy messengers. And then it says that names were written on them, on these gates, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. Now, Ezekiel 48 describes the temple and the millennial kingdom, and it also has names on it. And if we compare what's said back in the Old Testament with what's being described here, you can think of, on the eastern side would be Joseph and Benjamin and Dan. On the northern side, Levi, Judah, and Reuben. The southern side, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, and the western side, Naphtali, Asher, and Gad. In fact, verse 13, just to move through that, says there are three gates on the east and three gates on the north, three gates on the south, and three gates on the west. Again, John describing to us as much as possible the details of the city. Now, if you remember back to Revelation 7, when it talked about the 144,000, there are 12,000 from each tribe. The list there of the 12 tribes was different than you find in other parts of Scripture. Dan wasn't there. Manasseh was there instead. So we don't know exactly the names that are seen here, but we know when John sees it, he identifies them with the 12 tribes of Israel. Look now at the foundation stones, verse 14. Another distinguishing feature of the city's exterior. And the wall of the city, John writes, had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So these 12 foundation stones form sort of a continuous chain around the entire city, and they're divided up by 12 different gates, uniformly distributed, three on each side. And John says on these foundation stones are 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The names of the 12 apostles. You know, spiritually speaking, Ephesians 2:20 says that the church is built upon the foundation of the apostles. And so here, visibly, you have a picture of the spiritual truth. You have the city where the church will live, where followers of God will live, and that city's foundation stones are names of the apostles. What a great reminder for eternity of the truth that's spiritually communicated through Christ. It's not clear whether all 12 names of the apostles are on each stone, or there's one name per stone. But we understand that we'll see the names there somehow, some way. Peter, James, and John. Andrew, Peter's brother. Philip, Bartholomew. Thomas, Matthew. James, the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot. The first 11 are easy, right? What do you do with Judas? You know, there are places in the New Testament, John 20:24, for example, 1 Corinthians 15:5, another example, where the word 12 is used to describe just 11 people. It seems, though, that John does say 12 here, so we would say instead, this could be Matthias, the 12th one, who's added in Acts chapter 1 to the 11 original disciples. Or it could be the Apostle Paul. He played such a great role, such an important role in the early church. Again, we're not sure of the details here. We just know that like those 12 tribes of Israel written down, we have the 12 apostles written down. And when you think about the connection between the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles, you see at once the distinction and the unity between Old Testament and New Testament that will be there for eternity. Both God's people are still different in God's eternal economy because of the unique purpose that they had, the unique time that they lived as they followed after God. God has an eschatological role for each group of people. We've seen that through the book of Revelation, right? You see that in New Testament teaching. You certainly see that in Old Testament teaching. And as you take it as a whole, sometimes we get uncomfortable thinking about distinctions between people. I think the spirit of the age that we live in today just wants everybody just to all be the same. Throw out gender, throw out all distinction, let's just all be the same, kind of one human mass. But God works differently. He has worked differently in history. And he's going to have different plans and different roles for groups in the future. And it's all good. It's not something that's higher or lower, better and worse. All different roles that people will have in eternity. So there's a great fulfillment here of the promises God has given in ages past. Turn back to Hebrews 11 and see what it says here about our future as followers of God. Hebrews 11, verse 10. This is talking about the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And think about what we are reading now in Revelation and how it applies here to Hebrews 11. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Look now to verses 13 through 16. Talking about those who have come before us in Old Testament days. All these died in faith, without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So you think about great men and women of the faith who have come before us in New Testament days and in Old Testament days. All of us are looking to that same city. All of us are looking to live together with God that we follow, that we worship, and we'll be there together. That's glorious. That's wonderful. And we thank God for him giving some detail about what that will be like. Well, look now, secondly, at the city's staggering dimensions, verses 15 through 17. Look at the measuring first in verse 15. John writes, "The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall." A gold measuring rod, or a reed, usually about 10 feet long, and the fact that it's made of gold is totally appropriate because of the dignity of what he's about to measure. John couldn't gain this information regarding the size. He just said so far it's enormous, but he couldn't communicate the details until it was measured and told to him the details. The activity of the measurement is not given to us. We're just told the results of the measuring. So that begins in verse 16 with the shape. John says, "The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width." So the shape is a square. If you're going to look on it geographically from above, you'd see a square, and that's the city. And it's not kind of a square, not close to a square. It's an exact square, looking at it from above. He goes on and talks about the size in the middle of verse 16. "And he measured the city with the rod, 1,500 miles, its length and width and height are equal." More precisely, the words here are 1,200 stadia. 1,200 stadia. A single stadion would be somewhere between 600 and 660 feet. And if you do the math, then you come out with, as some of your translations might say, 1,500 miles. You think that's enough space? A city 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles? You think of where we will live and the number of followers of God there have been through all of creation? Picture this. If we start from right here where we are today in Southern California, 1,500 miles to the east would end us up in Alabama. If we go directly north, we'd be somewhere in the middle of Alberta, Canada. This is an immense place in which we live. John's word saying it was very costly and brilliant and it was great and it was high in describing it all. It's good that God had this angel measure it and tell John what the exact measurements were. Otherwise, we might minimize it, you know. We might think of the largest earthly city that's ever been or the largest city that's on earth right now, and we think of it as too puny. This thing is massive as far as its scale. I think the most impressive word in this verse that describes the size of this city is found at the end of verse 12. And that is the word, verse 16. That is the word height. Its length and its width, they're the same. But then it says its height is also the same. How high is this city? Well, 1,200 stadia. How high is that? Well, that's 1,500 miles. Let's think about that a little bit. Some people would say, well, the length and width, that's understandable. But its height, 1,500 miles, they would say, well, maybe it's kind of pyramid-shaped, and it goes to a point, or cone-shaped. But it seems like it would be better to take this as the city is cube-shaped. Same length, same width, same height. Do you know that the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple is cube-shaped? And we could say, well, perhaps God prefers cube-shaped dwelling places. And so he's just making this impressively large for us. Mankind's tallest skyscraper, aside from the Tower of Babel, we don't know how high that was. But today, the tallest skyscraper is in Dubai, and it is called the Burj Khalifa. 2,700 feet tall. Quite impressive if you look at the skyline. It's about a half a mile tall, 4 to 5 stadia. Mount Everest, 6 miles high. Difficult to breathe on top of Mount Everest because of the lack of oxygen. The cruising altitude of a commercial airline, 7 to 10 miles high. The SR-72, a military reconnaissance plane, the highest flying aircraft, 17 miles above the Earth. Earth's atmosphere officially ends at 62 miles above the Earth. The International Space Station orbits the Earth at 200 miles. There are other satellites that can be up to a couple thousand miles. As you think of pictures of a satellite in space, what's around it? It's just dark up there. And you see stars and such because the atmosphere of the Earth is gone when you get that high. Look down to verse 23 of the same chapter. It says, the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. So you think of the immense height of this city, and you think that it won't work because it's dark up there. Well, listen, there's no sun anyways. God himself and the illumination of the Lamb are shining through the city. So it doesn't matter how high or how long or how wide it is. God's there, and it is completely radiant. Imagine standing at the base of this thing and looking up. I mean, it would go seemingly forever. This is a massive structure. And even if we think in terms of today's Earth, this would definitely be visible from space, right? It would be sticking out on the side of the planet as people went by and say, what is that city there? That is incredible. Well, there is ample room here for God's glorified people to live. Stairs, elevators, we don't know. God doesn't tell us. We just know this is a massive structure, and God is communicating to us the details he wants to give us as John describes it. Well, the walls, look at verse 17. And he measured its wall 72 yards according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. And we're thankful that human measurements are angelic measurements, so we have understanding of what's going on here. Precisely when the angel measures its wall, it is 144 cubits, or as some of your translations might do the calculation for you, 216 feet or 72 yards. So you can think, well, wider than the width of a football field. Some people say, well, this is talking about the height of the wall. It seems, though, that that wouldn't make much sense because of the height of the city itself. The height of the city would dwarf even a wall that was 72 yards high. So it seems we're talking about the width of the wall here. And that makes sense. Its height seems to be more impressive. Back in verse 12, John does say that it had a great and high wall. And he describes the wall as high, even though the height of the city is 1,500 miles. So we take this 144 cubits as the width of the wall. So we see that the city itself is just glorious, that its dimensions are staggering as we compare them to today's life. Finally, let's look at the city's magnificent composition, beginning in verse 18. And again, John describes the wall. He's going to describe the makeup of what the city is composed of. He says, the material of the wall was jasper. Stop right there. It sparkled with a crystal-like radiance. Back in chapter 4 of the book of Revelation, God himself is described with the same word, jasper. And so there is a glory here, even in the wall of the city. It's a glow because the glory of God is there, illuminating everything that John sees. So the wall is like a diamond. You think of the precision with which a diamond cutter does his work. God so constructs the New Jerusalem in heaven, and it comes down that the transparency of his glory refracts and shimmers through the entire city, even the wall of the city. Look at the city itself, second half of verse 18. And the city was pure gold, like clear glass. This is beginning to sound more and more like John's description of God's throne in chapters 4 and 5. I think we can all think of a ring of gold, what that looks like, whether we own one or whether we've seen one. It's just a hint as we think of that ring of what this city is going to look like. There's a contrast here between the city itself and the walls. The gold is described as pure, so pure that it is transparent. This is greater than any known gold in present creation. This is see-through gold. John then describes the foundation stones, beginning in verse 19. And these foundation stones are large enough to extend above the ground so that they can be seen from John's vantage point. Verse 19, the foundation stones of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald. Some of these are familiar to us. Some of them we're not familiar with these words. What do they mean? Let me read through the rest of them, then we'll go back a little bit more slowly. The fifth, sardonyx, the sixth, sardius, the seventh, chrysolite, the eighth, beryl, the ninth, topaz, the tenth, chrysoprase, the 11th, jacinth, the 12th, amethyst. Let me give you just the variety, the shades of color that are seen here, not in order, but just in groupings of the different hues. Those that would be more bluish would be the sapphire, the jacinth, maybe a little bit more violet there, the amethyst. Those that would be more green would be the jasper, the chalcedony. That word comes from Chalcedon, Turkey, a bluish-green stone with stripes of different colors. The emerald would be a bright green, and beryl, a sea green. Finally, topaz, transparent yellow-green. Let me add chrysoprase to the green hues as well. The red hues would include sardonyx. It's kind of a red and white stone. Sardius, or a carnelian, usually a ruby red stone. This color is coupled with jasper in chapter 4, verse 3, to describe what emanates from God's throne. Jasper, sardius, green, red, as John described the glory of God there. Finally, yellow, that would be chrysolite, a golden color. Just a brilliant array of colors that John sees in the foundation stones. And again, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly which stone refers to what we have today because the names over the centuries have changed for these stones. When you think of the Old Testament breastplate of the priest described back in the earlier chapters of the Bible, 8 of the stones in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, are the same. The other 4 aren't found in the Septuagint, but, again, their names could have been changed, and there could be similar, if not identical, to what's described here. I think as you think of the breastplate of the Old Testament priest with what's described here, of greater importance is that privilege of the direct fellowship with God that we will share, that's represented in the foundation stones here, that was only for the priest in the Old Testament. We are God's priest here on earth because of what Christ has done to us. In this new city, there will be a privilege that belongs to all the people of God, and we praise Him for that. Think about a gemstone for a moment. What happens if you have a beautiful gemstone and you're in a dark closet? What does it look like? Well, it looks like a rock because there's no light. Gems need light for them to show their brilliance. Here, in the foundation stones, God's there, His light explodes out of the midst of the city, and the clarity of each gemstone is identifiable. The transparency of the material is seen by John as he's able to describe what goes on here as the light penetrates the foundation stones. This is going to be a continually glistening place. How beautiful. And in your mind, you might be thinking of foundation stones that are big rocks with tiny little gemstones in them. I think we should expand our minds and think, no, these are made out of gemstones, and it will be glorious to see. These are just the foundation stones as well. Now look at the gates, beginning of verse 21. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. That's something. Each one of the gates was a single pearl. That's larger than we're used to, right? a gate that is a single pearl. Now, pearls were highly valuable to ancients because their beauty was natural rather than man-made. Nothing had to be cut or done. They were just found, and they were beautiful in and of themselves. This was particularly true of the Roman world. One of the Roman Caesars tried to conquer Britain because of all the reports of pearl fisheries that were in that place at that time. We're not told how high each of these gates or how large each of these pearls will be, but with a 1,500-mile-high city, you would imagine they'd be quite large. However large they are, they're going to be beyond what we can imagine in our own day and age. Now, we have to talk about the street. Even the street is noteworthy. The middle and end of verse 21. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. This refers to the city's thoroughfare, maybe the square or multiple branches or arteries from the main street. In a typical ancient city, you had the main artery that led from the entrance gate to the king's palace. Here John describes what he sees with the singular word street of the city, not streets of the city. So somehow this is continuous. There's a connection here, even if it would change direction or join together with other streets coming from other gates. And he says that the street is pure gold, like transparent glass. Now there's a distinction here between the street and the city itself. Back in verse 18, literally, the material of the city is pure gold, pure glass. Here, the street is described with the words pure gold, transparent glass. So there's something John sees that's a little bit different, and it just takes time for us to meditate on what that must look like to see or mentally grasp the difference between the two. There are jokes that we have about people bringing gold with them to heaven, and they get to the front gates of heaven, and the question to them is, why would you want to bring pavement into heaven? This is just going to be commonplace. Everybody's going to see this. It's going to be something usual to us. And it's just some kind of wonderland as we look at it from this side of life. So John gives us here a description of our future home. He writes back to us, in a sense, saying, here's where we're going. This is going to be great. He describes here its glorious appearance, its staggering dimensions, and its magnificent composition. This is the content of the promise from Jesus when he says back in John 14, I go to prepare a place for you, to all those who have repented of their own way of life and given themselves, put their trust in, put their faith in Jesus Christ for life and godliness, trusting in his righteousness rather than their own. You think about God and you understand much from him, much about him from this passage. You see that our God is not a utilitarian God. He has reasons for everything he does, but he makes things beautiful. He is a God of wonder, a God of splendor. He's not just a scientific God, but he's an artistic God, and he blends those together in perfect harmony that he creates this city that awaits you and me. He could tell us more about the city. We wouldn't get it, though. It would be beyond us. He said, this is enough. Meditate on these things. This will take your entire life to understand deeply. God promises so much, and he will deliver. This is what awaits you, follower of Christ. 1 Corinthians 2:9, let me end with this. Just as it is written, this is a quote from Isaiah, things which eye has not seen, ear has not heard, which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. What a letter John has written to us here. What a letter God has written to us through John. This is our eternal home, and this should make us live for God here and now. Let's pray together.